Christmas is a time for seeing friends and family, but for some people this is more welcome than others. I found this cartoon in the week. I wonder if we could just swap over to the laptop. I don't know if that sums up your attitude to some of the seeing family and friends at Christmas. Obviously someone was feeling a little bit grumpy when they drew that cartoon. But it can feel a little bit onerous, can't it, sometimes, having to do all the visits and all the, you know, being with people. And sometimes visitors are surprising, aren't they? And sometimes they're welcome. Sometimes it's a lovely surprise. And sometimes they are less welcome. Well, when Alan and I were first married and we were living in Yorkshire and we were both working really horrible shifts at two different hospitals, we received a phone call. Alan received a phone call while I was on a late shift to say that one of his uncles and aunties were coming to visit us the next day in a surprise visit. Well, we were somewhat perturbed about this because we didn't actually know them terribly well, but what we did know about them was they were quite posh. And we had very little time in between a late and an early shift to make our house tidy, to get something together for a meal for when they arrived, and sort of look vaguely welcome for when they came to visit us. But then a realisation dawned on us and we became even more anxious when we remembered in horror that when we had been married, they had given us a pair of second-hand chairs. Now, they even mentioned the chairs in the phone call, and we realised that we were in for a very, very uncomfortable visit. It's not that we didn't have the chairs anymore. We had one of them, and the other one was safely stored in the garage. It's just that our dog... And this is... This is kind of what he looked like. This is kind of what every dog in Yorkshire looked like. But our dog, Adrian, had eaten said chair. Now, this wasn't unusual for our dog. We were terrible dog owners, but he was a very naughty dog. He ate everything from my glasses to the curry off your plate and the beer in your glass. He could open kitchen cupboards, even with child locks on. And he would take the food out of the freezer, and on one memorable occasion, he managed to spread it all over the lawn to defrost in the sun, much to our neighbour's amusement. He lived to eat, and so an armchair was just part of his normal diet if we happened to be out and he got a bit bored. And this particular chair was so badly chewed in one afternoon when he was in the house alone that we had come home and thought we'd been burgled, and it did look something like this. So when the uncle and auntie visited, not only did they remember about the chair, but when they couldn't see it in our house, they asked if we'd finished using it so they could give it to someone else. And we had to come clean. It was a very uncomfortable visit. Now the prophet Malachi is trying to prepare his people for a very uncomfortable visit. We think he was prophesying at the time of Nehemiah and Ezra, as many of the problems that he addresses are the ones that they faced when encouraging the people to rebuild the wall in Jerusalem and rediscover their faith in the one true God. And the thing is, the people had come back from exile and were settling down in Judah, but they had lost their way. They had forgotten how faithful God had been to them. And they were living in ungrateful ignorance. And their ungrateful behaviour was a bit more serious than a dog eating a chair given as a wedding present. They had married outside of the faith. They'd been unfaithful to those husbands and wives. Their priests had become cold and mechanical in their worship. And the people had forgotten their duty to pay a tithe to the God who had given them everything. They were a people living in hard financial times, feeling the squeeze, anxiously watching the harvests, pulling in their belts and feeling like a very insignificant, struggling nation in a world where they were surrounded by rich superpowers. And in that climate, who can blame them for reducing their giving? Except Malachi does blame them. You see, God had gone a bit quiet over the last couple of hundred years. Gone were the glory days of Elijah. God had long since given up his pyrotechnics and displays of power. These people were following a God who had gone silent. Can we blame them for losing their faith? Except Malachi does blame them. You see, Malachi, in his role as God's spokesperson, speaks to his people like an inconvenient family visitor about to descend on a relative who hasn't given him a thought in years. Malachi brings a message designed to wake his people up. It's a message that tells them God has noticed their ungrateful behaviour and is going to send someone round. So what does God have to say to his people to wake them up? Well, the first thing I think we need to remember that God says to them is, I, the Lord, do not change. God's message to his people through Malachi is to remind them that they have drifted apart. And guess who has moved? God emphatically tells them that he hasn't changed. He remains faithful and loving, steadfast and certain. He is still the one thing they can count on, the one certain presence in an ever-changing world. They might have drifted away from the covenant, but God has stayed exactly where he always is, faithfully upholding his end of the agreement. But you will notice that this statement is in a funny tense. Now, if I was really good at English, I'd know which tense it was. But it's kind of present perfect, I'm guessing there. But it's I do not change, not I have not changed, not I will not change. Is that present continuous? I don't know. But it's interesting, isn't it? I do not change. I didn't change in the past. I will not change in the future. I do not change. This statement from God is as fresh and relevant for us as it was for Judah back then. And we don't have to have had three deaths in the family in one weekend to know that the world can change radically overnight, can't it? All sorts of things can happen in our lives and in the world that make us feel like suddenly the world isn't a place we know very well anymore. And in those times, we need to know that truth. That the Lord our God is a God who does not change. And if we are feeling a long way away from God, well, guess who's moved? And the subtle changes in the behaviour of the people of Judah are not so far from our own lifestyles today. And yet God does not change. But God says some less comforting things, doesn't he? He says, will a man rob God, yet you rob me? This is a frightening thing for God to say. He doesn't hold back. And I imagine being on the receiving end of this is a wee bit more uncomfortable than an awkward visit from an uncle and aunt. The people had hit on hard times. They felt vulnerable and they had stopped giving. And the problem with that, as we will find out, is that it puts them in the worst kind of vicious cycle. The covenant God had with his people was that whatever happened, if they recognized that all that they had was from God, and if they gave him back 10%, they would always have enough. Enough. Not excess. Enough. This is not a justification for the abhorrent prosperity teaching we see across the pond. But the people forgot to give back to God, and so they didn't have enough. And so they felt even more anxious and gave even less, and so on and so on. Now, we've been talking about giving quite a lot in our church in recent days. And we are all feeling the pinch of a flat economy. And yet we need to be careful that we don't forget whose our money is in the first place. If we see it as ours and give God bits of our spare, then we are robbing God. He takes that very, very seriously. We can find ourselves in the same vicious cycle as the people of Judah. And what we know about this is that you can't feel God's blessing when you are diddling him out of what is his. So the third thing God says to them is, test me in this. God is angry, but he is also incredibly gracious. He isn't some despot demanding unfair taxes. He says, try me. See if you end up worse off. Put me to the test. See if I let you down. The reason God wants us to give sacrificially is not because he wants all our stuff, but that it is the only way we can experience what an amazing provider he is. By giving back to him what we think we can't manage without, we find out that he gives back 10, 20, 100-fold. Because here's the thing, no matter how hard we try, we simply cannot outgive God. It is an essential part of his character to be outrageously generous. He loves to lavish gifts on his children. But what breaks his heart is when his children take those gifts for granted and forget who the giver is. Now, we have opportunities to do exciting things for God in this part of the world. He's given us potential harvest fields that we could have the joys of seeing being gathered in. The new school being built down the road. The parish nurse project. The new housing that's going to be built in between Croxley and Watford. I wonder if we're hearing God's voice in that. I wonder if we hear him saying, test me in this and see if I will not throw open the floodgates of heaven and pour out so much blessing, you will not have room for it. Isn't that a wonderful phrase? So typical of God's version of giving, isn't it? We're just going to give back the same as we give to him. But to pour out of heaven, to open the floodgates. These are the words God uses to even his half-hearted, wayward people. The whole reason he's upset is that he doesn't want them to miss it. He has gifts in store for them that his people sadly never see, because in all their history, they never quite managed to take God at his word and live up to the law he gave them. God offers them plenty and peace in the here and now, but he also gives them a sneak preview of what he has up his sleeve for later. Like an excited parent who can't keep a secret about the amazing Christmas present bought for a much-loved child, God can't help giving hints about his most amazing gift yet. Not content with a loving covenant that should have kept his people safe and well provided for if they'd trusted him, God prepares for centuries to send his own son. And instead of losing patience with human beings who just don't get it, he stops trying to explain via messengers and comes in person. Advent is about joining in that expectant wait that the prophets felt and the people tried in vain to understand. His coming is not at all like an unwelcome relative if we are ready and waiting. His coming is much more like hearing the letterbox flap as a long-awaited parcel lands on the doormat. It's all about being ready. And this Christmas, we may feel like we're struggling. We may feel as though faith has deserted us, and testing God to see if he is faithful may sound like the last thing we want to do. Well, God says that even that's okay, because all we have to do is look for him. Did you spot those lovely words at the end of Malachi? But for you who revere my name, the Son of Righteousness will rise with healing in its wings. They're very well-known words, aren't they, from a carol? We sing them every Christmas. And yet I wonder if we know them to be true ourselves. Are you looking this Christmas? Why not test him and see and experience the healing in his wings and the blessing poured from the floodgates of heaven? Amen.